Liveline on RTE Radio 1 with bonkers.ie, Ireland's favourite comparison and switching website. Visit bonkers.ie today and start saving on your household bills.
1850 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon, and you're very welcome to Liveline. And 51551 is our text number, and joe at rte.ie. Let me, first of all, offer condolences to two friends, not just work colleagues of Gay Byrne, Maura Connolly, who you all know. 30 years Maura Connolly on the Late Late Show. Maura, good afternoon. His right-hand woman, is that what people used to refer to you as, Maura?
Well, yes, it was.
Okay, and condolences to you, Maura. I know how close
you
were. Now, just I want to also introduce Roger Childs. Roger, good afternoon.
Hello, Joe.
And Roger latterly would have worked with Gay for many years, Roger?
I'm a latecomer to the feast.
Yeah.
I first started working with Gay in 2009. 10 years into his retirement, supposedly.
Well done on the meaning of life. And Roger is commissioning editor of religious programmes here in RTE.
Oh, God. I have to turn off the phone, sorry.
Someone is ringing, Maura. As Gay would say, someone is ringing you, Maura, to tell you you're on the radio. And you're on the radio now. You okay, Maura? Okay. Well, it's gone for a second. Roger, how did you meet? Are you back?
Mark, great. Sorry, it's off now.
That's fine. That's absolutely fine.
How
are you, Maura?
Well, I'm fine, but I'm obviously saddened, and it's the end of an era.
Yeah.
And Gay was, I was very happy to work and very lucky to work with Gay for 30 years. He was an absolutely brilliant boss to have and a fantastic leader. He was very, very kind, generous, and very straight man. He was just a wonderful, wonderful, and we all felt the same about him. I've had so many calls from past colleagues, from everybody who ever knew him, from Donegal to Tralee, because I used to work with him on the roads of Tralee for 17 years. And, you know, it's amazing how many people he touched. And as you probably know, the Rose of Tralee and the Toy Show were the two highest rating programmes of the entire RTE output.
Yeah.
And Gay was just a fantastic human being. He hated to be called a professional, but he was an absolute professional. And he always had an excess of knowledge to the requirements of any job that he did. And as you know, he illuminated the lives of the people of Ireland and gave them a platform in which to speak their minds and affected social change to a huge extent. We were a very parochial nation before the Late Late Show. That's not too big a thing to say.
Yeah.
But he was a wonderful, wonderful person. And what a lot of people mightn't have known was that he was an extremely modest man.
Yeah.
And he would listen to even the small... He had a big ear to listen to the smallest voice. And when I joined him, you know, he gave me as much attention as he did the researchers, because when I started, I was working as the secretary to the head of Light Entertainment, Adrian Cronin, who was also the director of the Late Late. And part of that came with, of my job, I was also the hostess on the Late Late. And that's when I met Gay first.
Right.
And he was always very welcoming. And then Gay's secretary, Joan Toohey, left to do a primary school teaching course. And she was only allowed off RTE if her job wasn't replaced. So I worked for both Gay and Adrian for a year. And after the year, Adrian came in one day and said, you know, I have a new secretary for you, Gay. And he said, I'll have Maura, you keep the new secretary.
Brilliant.
And so I moved into the Late Late, and normally up to then, secretaries weren't invited to join the research meetings.
Yeah.
But from day one, he invited me, and because he knew me for a year at that stage. and he was always very supportive and great person to teach you the trade in the lightest possible manner, and great to give compliments. And I think he's about the only broadcaster I've ever heard who has given on-air credits to researchers. We get written credits, all right, but to give verbal on-air credits, he was very generous. And I don't know what else to say. I could never say enough about it.
I know, I'll prompt you in a few moments, but that was absolutely beautiful, Maura. Roger, you met Gay in 2009 when he had retired. How did that come about, and how did you come to meet him?
Well, it was our former colleague Mary Curtis who first suggested that when I came up with this half-baked idea to do a religious interview series called The Meaning of Life, that the best person to present it might be Ireland's most beloved entertainer.
Yeah.
Because we wanted to send a signal to the mainstream audiences that this, you know, a lot of people were sceptical about institutional religion, so we needed to put down a welcoming mat for them. So I wrote to Gay and got a summons to a Chinese restaurant in Donnybrook, which he used to frequent.
The Furama, yes.
And it was very clear from the word go that I was being auditioned, not the other way around.
And when you arrived, Roger, was he in at his usual table, and did he have a little glass of sherry?
Jemmy.
Jemmy, okay. This was 2009, okay.
And he very quickly told me he said, this idea will never work.
Okay.
It's two people in a room talking about God. I can't think of anything more boring. But I could tell as he said it that there was a twinkle in his eye, and actually he was interested in the concept. He liked the idea too that even though it pretended to be a celebrity interview series, a chat show, it was nothing of the sort. We weren't talking to those people as stars, we were talking to them as people.
Mm-hmm.
And whereas normally the guests, the caliber of guests that we were attracting would be on to promote product or project.
Yeah.
He would say, I'm not interested in any of that. I'm interested in you. And that was the secret of The Meaning of Life. That's why it worked. And that's why we went to places with them. They mined places that they wouldn't in other interviews.
Yeah. Some of them were 13 series, Roger.
13 series, 78 programs, 2 books. Yep, he kept me busy.
Okay, so was Gay born religious?
Yes. He was.
Yes.
I'm
Maura.
Very rude.
Yes, Maura. No, come in, Maura. That's
I'm
what it's about.
I'm jumping in here.
Please do.
Yes. Gay, before, he would leave Howth very early in the morning.
Okay.
When he was on his radio program. And he would go to the Sacred Heart Church, Donnybrook.
All right.
And go to Mass every day before the program, and then come to the late at 8 o'clock.
Okay.
And he never wore religion or politics on his sleeve for working. He always remained, you know, neutral. And that was the secret, you know, because he gave other people platforms, but he was a deeply religious, beautiful man, and a very high sense of integrity and justice, you know. So
he used to say, Roger, to me, though, that he was hanging on by his fingernails. And actually, his private beliefs or lack of them remained a bit of a mystery to me, and I think that's the way he wanted it.
Yes.
That initial conversation we had, one of the things that he was most at pains to do was to make sure that I wasn't going to ask him to be publicly religious, and I didn't want him to be. I know that it's broadcaster's death as soon as you nail your colours to the mast politically or religiously, because you invite people to put you in a box.
Yeah. And that's the journalist's belief, too, that you don't give away what your beliefs are. Very important.
And,
but I think now that he's gone, it's okay to say.
Yeah, absolutely. But Roger, what do you mean he was hanging on by his fingernails? Do you mean the last few years, or with the changes in the revelations about the Catholic Church? What?
Yes, I mean, it was only a sort of throwaway remark that he made. He didn't go into great detail about his scruples or troubled soul, but, you know, he had eyes to see the difficulties that, in particular, the church in which he'd grown up was going through. And he was a sceptical questioning, he had a sceptical questioning mind, but that didn't mean that he was kicking over the traces. Far from it, I think.
Yeah. And Maura, like, he still had no fear. I know, I take your point about him being very religious, but he still had no fear of exposing the Catholic Church if that had to be done.
Oh, no. Anything that was considered to be fair, you know, he wanted. And he always had guests who were for and against. But, I mean, you had to speak out when things were going downwards, so to speak. And that was very important, because that was yet another platform for people to speak of the injustices that had been done to them, which was very sad. I mean, it saddened everybody of our age group, if you like, to think that, you know, things that we revered were so corrupt, really.
Yeah, yeah.
That's an awful word to say. And then the sad thing about that is there are so many good people in the church, and they have been branded with, you know,
the same, yeah, same
not the best, you know.
And was he, people should put this in context as well about his affection. Maybe you can help us here, Maura. His affection for on the one hand, Bishop Eamon Casey, and then the interview with Annie Murphy, which has been played again and again.
Yes.
In the. How was he after that interview? Because it's him we're talking about.
Yeah. Well, everything that was said on the programme that night was already in her book.
Okay.
You know,
yeah.
So he wasn't revealing anything different, but I think it was some of the Galway people in the audience went up in arms, and so she did, and she stood up to walk out, and he was quite upset about that, you know. But then, as we all said to him, look, it's all in the book, so, you know, we weren't telling any, you know, you weren't revealing any new secrets there.
But was he upset after the reaction to that question he asked? Well, if Eamon Casey, if Peter, the son of, by the way, two people who were in love and had a baby, it's not
exactly
a crime. But if Peter was half the man his father was, now that seemed to
And he never really liked to talk about that afterwards, because he just anything like that, he just liked to move on.
Yeah.
You know, that was then, this is now, let's get on with it, you know.
What I would add to that, though, Maura, is that he was endlessly self-critical to a surprising extent.
Absolutely.
You know, he would review every programme. He would go over in his head, could I have asked that better?
Mm-hmm.
Did I tackle that well? He had antennae twitching for criticism because he always wanted to improve.
Yes.
And really quite hard on himself, which was surprising for someone who'd been in the game that long and was that good. But I think that was part of his success, was never resting on those laurels, always looking to do it better.
And was part of his modesty too.
Yeah.
Yep.
You know. And Maura, how did he cope with the Russell Murphy affair? First, for people to might not remember, it's around 1984, Russell Murphy, who was an accountant, wasn't he, Maura? He died. He was Gaelic. He was accountant to a number of people, you, Leonard.
Oh, he was accountant for many of the stars, and he was very well in with the Bank of Ireland. He was a director. And he was Gay's best friend, male friend. Mm-hmm. He was his best man. He was Crona's godchild.
Wow.
And Gay trusted him implicitly, you know, in everything.
Yeah.
So I remember on the Monday morning, the Monday before he was due to go to the Netherlands to do the radio coverage of the Eurovision Song Contest, and he rang me at about 8 in the morning. He said, Maura, something dreadful has happened.
Right.
Come in immediately. And I said, what is it, Gay? Is Kathleen okay? Are the children okay?
Yeah, yeah.
They are. It's Russell. Just come in, Maura.
Okay.
So I came in immediately, and I said, what is it? He said, oh, the accountants from the office were out. Russell has taken all my money, and everything that I have, and there's nothing that can be done. And they were full of apologies.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he was in bits, God love him. And I said, Gay, you have to do a programme now.
Yeah.
So just put that on ice. Concentrate on the programme. Get over it. and I'll see you afterwards in the canteen. And in the meantime, I'll get on to a solicitor and see if there's anything that can be done.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what he did. He went, how he did the program, I don't know, because he was in smithereens.
Yeah.
And he was in his 50s then, as far as I can remember.
Yeah, 57,
so,
I think. More.
So most of his life, you know, everything that he had earned was literally gone by somebody he had trusted. And he had even seen Russell a night or two before he died, and he had said to him, is there anything you need to tell me, Russell, you know,
mm-hmm.
and blah, blah, blah. And of course, Russell just said, no, nothing. And so...
And he went, did he not say at one stage, Maura, he went to Russell Murphy's funeral and, and he cried.
Yes, he
That's
did.
How close
and
he
was. I was with him.
Yeah.
And so was Kathleen, obviously, because they were all very good friends.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a terrible thing to say, but he had been a very good friend of the family. And, he did cry.
And just, I think this is a fascinating insight, which... into Gay's personality. He was working from 1958, sponsor programmes, and then he worked in the UK. So he was earning, I don't know what the money was like then, so he was earning from 58 to 84. Russell Murphy was his accountant.
Yes.
But why did he, what was it in Gay that so implicitly trusted Russell Murphy, who was from a completely different background than Gay, as far as I know, to such an extent that he gave Russell Murphy, this is how he robbed the money, let's be blunt, he gave Russell Murphy the power of attorney, the power to write cheques in Gay's name.
Well, Gay didn't know that he had given him the power of attorney because he would arrive out in his chauffeur-driven car and ask Gay to sign various things after the radio programme and before he came over to the Late Late. And it was amongst a wodge of stuff that he was signing. And, of course, he didn't have time to read them. And, as I said before, he trusted Russell, like, implicitly.
But why? Have you any sense why, Maura? Was it... I don't know... Gay was from Rialto. He loved.
Yes.
He was the youngest child, as you know.
Yes.
Annie was his mother. His mother died on Christmas Eve.
Oh, his mother adored him.
Yes, and she used to give him the egg flip every morning, and she used to slip in a drop of whiskey. He never knew it, of course. As he arrived in Sing Street, Stoches. Now he didn't arrive, but of course he didn't.
Yes.
But she used to slip a drop of whiskey for his good health into her baby son's baby boy. She loved him so much. Now, is it that he came from not a well-off background? And was he beguiled, bemused? We know he was defrauded, but how could he have fallen into that trap without even suspecting until the day, and after the day he died?
Yeah, well, it wasn't even after the day. It was, you know, it was even the accountants there had no idea that the books were in such a bad state, you know. But no, Gay had come from a very straight background, a very religious woman.
Yeah.
And as you might have heard Mary, his sister, saying, like, she ruled the nest and Gay was the youngest and he was her. She adored him.
Yeah.
But as well as that, when his father used to come home with his wages, he'd put them up on the mantelpiece. And the mother would take care of them. She was the manager.
Yeah.
And the same thing happened with Gay. She'd take care and she used to have a notebook and she'd write in what checks he had given.
Okay.
And then she'd write what money was taken or what she had given back to him.
Mm-hmm.
And the rest would go to the Royal Bank. And I think what happened is that his mother was so straight.
Yeah.
And sorry to say this about Russell, but he used to go to St. Teresa's Church in Clarendon Street to Mass every day.
Yeah.
And Gay assumed that he was what he looked to be. You know, what he seemed to practice was, because he'd pull you up, Russell would pull you up if you said anything incorrect or...
What do you...
You know,
yeah.
and
Anyway, no, I take about him. I'm always, and that's by the way, that's a fascinating insight as well about his mother and his relationship with his mother and how he implicitly, and just to remind, we won't go into
and
the story.
And when he did trust people, he trusted them. I mean, once he had tried researchers, me, anybody else, once he trusted you to work on the programme and to deliver everything correctly, then that was it. He gave you your head. Yeah. And he was very good at delegating, and you know, you daren't come back, you daren't give him a wrong designation for somebody's title.
Oh, I know that. Oh, I know that.
He was a brilliant teacher,
he
you
was
know.
Brilliant at that, and so correct as well.
Absolutely.
So, yeah.
It's worth pointing out, Roger, Joe, that neither he nor Kathleen ever badmouthed that accountant publicly, and in fact Kathleen spoke really graciously a couple of weeks ago in an interview when she was asked, because people always bring it up, but she spoke yet again saying, no, he's got family who might be hurt if we raise those old matters.
And it's what it says about Gay and indeed Kathleen, their reaction to that catastrophic financial blow that says so much about them. It really does say so much about
them. Well, it was in books and newspapers and everything, but yes, it was dreadful. And he was magnificent, how he just went on, did all the programmes, and,
didn't he fly off the next day and present the Eurovision?
He was doing the Eurovision commentary for radio for, it was the Netherlands.
And is it true, Maura, fish and chips every Friday in the canteen?
No,
in RTE?
That's not true.
No, egg and chips.
Yes.
Why not? Well, why not fish and chips?
No, he just took egg and chips because that's what he took. And that was his dinner until after the Late Late Show, you know.
And they still serve it.
They do, and a lot of people in here still get it on a Friday, almost in Gay's honour. But I read somewhere that he said egg and chips because egg and chips on a Friday, because you can't get food poisoning from egg and chips. He obviously had never heard of salmonella. But anyway, his routine, Maura, was, as people describe it, was that he was very much a man of routine.
Absolutely, And he had a small little briefcase,
leather,
which he had since he started out, I think. And at one stage, all the stitching went, and he asked me if I could get it fixed, and I brought it up to the local shoemaker, and it continued on till the end of when he was finished.
That's right. I remember seeing him with it in 1966. I was 10 in Moosey, believe it or not. Yeah. Roger, I know you want to mention a number of interviews, but you want to mention one person in particular who was taken by him, and that's Charles Spencer, Earl Charles Spencer. We know him especially from his incredible moving eulogy at the funeral of his sister, Princess Diana. Roger, the memorable... First of all, was it hard to get people to sit down and talk about God? I suspect it would have been.
Well, I think people were wary until they actually sat down in the chair opposite. But Gay had this brilliant ability to put guests at ease. And Charles was like that. Charles was actually over promoting a book. Mm-hmm. And unlike a lot of interviewers, Gay had taken the trouble to read it cover to cover the day before, but also gave a lot of thought to the interview and therefore addressed what Charles was interested in and only approached personal matters through that prism. And Charles afterwards talked about being bewitched by him. He said, I entered the room with no intention of talking that personally about matters concerning my family, my grief, and he put me in a place where I just felt comfortable revealing all of that.
Well, we're happy to say Earl Charles Spencer is on the line. Charles, good afternoon.
Hello, Joe.
And I know your book was you are a historian. I've seen you talk at the Festival of History in Dublin, and your knowledge is incredible. But tell us about, because Charles, people will associate you with the eulogy at your dear sister's obsequies and the fact that you were very upset about the behaviour of the media and journalists. But tell us what you want to say about Gay Bourne.
Well, it's Roger touched on it, actually. I mean, I turned up to be interviewed by him, intrigued, obviously, because of his reputation and the length of his career and the heights he had reached. But I hadn't really thought about the fundamental question that he was going to put to me, which is, was the meaning of life. So mm-hmm. it was an incredibly intense experience. I don't know what happened in that room. He interviewed me in a hotel room with many camera crews in there, and somehow we just locked into each other and into this incredibly deep and serious conversation. Mm-hmm. But I never felt that I was being taken advantage of. You know, as Roger just mentioned, the questions got into a very personal area and all of that. But I never felt in any way defiled. I felt I was in the presence of a very great journalist and a very great man. And it was an enormous privilege to share that experience with him.
And would you have been aware or conscious, Charles, during the interview, that he was developing a great affect? Because a great affection for you. And
well, it's so
that he was impressed by you, I suppose.
But I mean, I'm very touched if he did. But it was so interesting because I think he came to me quite warily. You know, I'm sort of come from an incredibly privileged English background and all of that. But we broke through very early on. I remember he was particularly intrigued. He asked me about my time at Oxford University and asked me if I had joined the infamous dining club, the Bullingdon.
I said,
well, actually, no, I came back to find my room turned over by the Bullingdon, but I didn't want to be part of their club. And he was so intrigued by that. And I think that formed a little bond early on. And he came back to that a couple of times. He just thought that was very unusual. But we just, I think, just man for man, we really liked each other, and I totally respected him. And I know this sounds perhaps a little pretentious, but the atmosphere in that room when we were talking was mm-hmm. really something very special indeed. And I could tell at the end that I was, I'd been sort of exhausted by it, because he'd really put me through my paces. He made me think about very profound things, but also he put me on the spot, so I had to be honest and clear. And it was a master interview. I never saw the program itself, but Roger told me a few people have watched it. And it's just it's one of those things where I felt I'd been in the presence of greatness by being in that room with him talking on such a subject.
And Charles,
it was actually the most watched program in 13 series, Charles, so you did something right.
Well, I think he did it right.
And what did he say to you afterwards, Charles? Is that a fair question, or do you want to...
Afterwards, I think we were both completely exhausted by it, actually. We obviously did develop an affection for each other from going through that experience together. I know it sounds rather pretentious, as I say, to talk about an experience just from one very intense interview, but it was something that we shared. And Roger, I think, was in the room, but it was an extraordinary atmosphere.
Incredible, and they're lovely words, and I know you want to offer your condolences to.
I do Kathleen and his family and friends, wider family and friends, and also to the people of Ireland. What a wonderful representative he was of your nation.
Okay. Well, Charles, you wrote some lovely things online yesterday, and I intend to forward them to Kathleen because they were very touching.
Wonderful. Well, that would be very kind.
And what you said, Charles, is this is very sad news indeed. I had the honour to be interviewed by Gay Byrne, and he was, without doubt, the greatest journalist I've ever met, both as a human and as a professional. A fascinating mind and a bewitching presence. Sincere condolences to his family and friends. You're not just a very good historian, you're a very good writer as well, Charles. Well
done. Thank
you, Joe. Okay, Charles, thank you for your time, and back in Dublin soon, I hope, at another history festival.
Wonderful.
History festival is still thriving. It's one of the biggest events.
Thank you so much.
Okay, that's Earl Charles Spencer. Roger, stay with us if you could, please, and likewise. Roger, I want to, again, these questions. Remember at the end, Maury, you'd know this as well, at the end of every meaning of life, you do the Pearly Gates question. What would you say to God? Will you contemplate that over the next 2 minutes or so, Roger, and indeed Maura, and I want a clear, concise answer that's not here in my brief because it's live line. But I'm fascinated by Maura's insights, and I'm fascinated the two of you having worked with him at different periods of his life. And I know, Maura, you kept in close touch with him right until the end. But back after this break, 51551, Joe at RTE.ie.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1 with Bonkers.ie. Loyalty doesn't always pay, so visit Bonkers.ie today.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
And just to remind people, there's a special late show tonight at 9:35. I presume it is 9:35 on RT1 television, which I'm told will have an audience full of his friends and admirers. It'll be like a drive-through celebration of Gayborn. There's so many people, but it'll be fantastic. And I should also mention, after the late, if it doesn't go on till midnight, which it probably will, after the late, there's a scheduled re-showing of Children of the Troubles, the documentary, which we broadcast last night between the news and Clare Bourne. Roger Childs, the Pearly Gates question. Let's hear Gay ask Noel Gallagher that exact question.
Suppose, Noel, it is all true.
Mm.
When you get there to the Pearly Gates and he/she is standing in front of you, what will you say?
I'd say, you've heard Don't Look Back in Anger, right? And they'd say, of course. And I'd say, well, look, it's me. Let us in. I can play your tune. I robbed some stuff. I took a lot of drugs. But I'm all right. I can write a song. Let us in. I can't play the harp, though.
That's Noel Gallagher asking that question. Roger, did you ever say that to Gay? Gay, what would you say to God? A cup of tea afterwards or a cup of coffee or...
If I had a euro for every person who said... Somebody should ask Gay the questions that he asks on The Meaning of Life. Yeah. There's absolutely no way he'd ever have agreed to sit in the chair and answer them. I think it's an intriguing question, though. Let's just suppose, as he did, that he is now at the Pearly Gates and might have an opportunity to have that conversation. What would he say? I suspect he'll say very little, just enough to get God to give the answers that we're all wanting to hear. I suspect, even though Gay was not remotely starstruck, you know, he turned down Bill Clinton twice for our series. He'd interviewed Mother Teresa, Neil Armstrong, the Beatles. You know, there weren't many that he.
Why did he turn down Bill Clinton?
Bill Clinton was offered to us once, and it had taken me a lot to get him to agree to an interview.
I know how dogged you are.
And it was the first offer was. New York, this coming Sunday, go. And Gay said, no, I've got my Lyric FM show. I've got loyal listeners. And I said, Gay, I will produce your Lyric FM show and we'll do it from New York. And he said, no. It was too much trouble. And then Bill Clinton came to Dublin.
Right.
And I received a phone call at fairly short notice saying it's going to happen at the Shelbourne Hotel in this particular room at 2:30 on Wednesday. So I said, perfect, thank you very much, we'll go with that. Phoned Gay and he said, no, can't do that, I'm doing my one man plus woman show in Galway on Wednesday.
Wow.
And I said, I've thought of that, Gay, I can get you across country in time for Curtain Up. And he said, no, because he'll overrun, I'll turn up sweaty, the people of Galway have paid to see me, he has not. And I had to make his excuses for him.
Incredible.
But back to the question, what would he say to God?
I
suspect he'd actually say something like, you've got some explaining to do, and then just sit back and listen, because he was actually a very good listener.
Yeah. And Maura, did you watch The Meaning of Life?
I did, but I actually didn't have anything to do with the input of it.
Yeah,
it was Margaret Martin, researcher, who had been a researcher
Margaret
with
Martin,
us. And no, he used to ask me, he'd tell me who he was having on, and he used to ask me, you know, what did I think, and he gave me some of the tapes to view, but that was about as much, you know, as I had to do with it. Which
and Maura, the time he was asked, or he was approached by Fianna Fáil, by Micheál Martin, who, by the way, I met on the... He was one of the first on the queue this morning to sign the book of condolences at the Mansion House, in fairness to him. But Micheál, how was Gay ever seriously considering that, do you think?
No, I don't think he was. I mean, his answer to that was he was a broadcaster. He wasn't a president. And I would have loved if he had gone. But
would you? Yeah, why?
Yeah, I would
have.
Yeah, I think he would have been brilliant.
Yeah.
I mean, You know, Gay was such a very safe pair of hands and such a man of such high integrity. That's not to take away from Michael D now.
Of course, yeah, yeah.
But, yeah, I would have loved, but the family took a decision and he took a decision that no, it wasn't for him. Much as he was honoured to be asked, it was a no. And he came back to Micheál Martin as quickly as he could.
Okay.
To say that.
It said a lot about him that he nearly became, well, he was the runaway favourite for the presidency without ever declaring or standing.
Yes, exactly.
And Maura, was he stung by any of the criticism? Some of the newspapers turned against him when his name was called him. He was a light entertainer and that was no way.
Yeah.
It was kind of the argument and some of the political correspondence. Well, the whole sense was, well, hang on a minute. No, this job is for politicians. It's not for showbiz people.
Yes.
Was he stung by any of that?
I don't believe he was, because Gay had been used to a lot of criticism during the whole reign, and a lot of irate callers coming on, etc. If we covered anything like sex or divorce, so he was used to it, and he would just say, "Let them have it," and they get tired writing about it, and if you don't give them a response, they've nothing to go on with the next day for the next headlines, you know.
Okay, Roger, stay there, Maura. Roger Childs mentioned the Beatles, Gay boring boring interviewing the Beatles. By the way, there's a lovely tweet. It's on Twitter and on the RT account by our own Sinead Crowley of it's 8.5 minutes of Gay's career. I think it's beautifully crafted. And Pete, the Beatles and Gay Bourne, what's your connection, Pete?
Oh, my goodness. Just listening to Maura's voice there brings back such wonderful memories. I grew up with Gay throughout the years, but with the Beatles connection, I set up Beatles Ireland to do with the Irish connection that hadn't been done before.
Okay.
And I was obviously Gay marked out, but I was very young at the time, and I was a novice. And at one of my first interviews was to do with Gay. Maura rang me up, and her voice said, "Would you like to talk to Gay now?" I was petrified, but within 2 or 3 minutes, he just put you at so much ease. He, because of his connection with seeing the Beatles in the cavern, that was one part, and then of course the Ken Dodd, the interview with the Beatles and Ken Dodd, he loved that period. He actually so much enjoyed it, and listening to telling his stories about asking to be the Beatles asking him to be their Beatles manager.
Yeah, let's listen to Gay Bourne. It's on Granada Television and it's one of the first interviews.
That's right.
That the Beatles...
And Joe, if I could just say,
Maura,
believe it or not, Michael Parkinson was his producer.
Wow.
And he always said that Gay was the best talk show host that in the entire world, you know.
Okay, this is Gay Bourne interview.
Yeah.
It's about 40 seconds now.
We have always thought that it might be a good question to put to Mr. Kenneth Dodd and the members of the Beatles. To what extent do they attribute their success to their hairstyles? And we'll start by asking that question now of Mr. Ken Dodd.
We call it her in Liverpool, you see. We always had the Judy with the fur her.
We have
a fellow went into one of those shops once in Liverpool where they sell those, minks and things, and he says to the girl, he said, "Give us one of those hurry coats." I say, "I beg your pardon, sir, what fur?" He said, "Fur the Judy, who do you think?"
Do you think that he owes a lot of his success to his hairstyle, fellas?
No, I don't think it helped at all.
That was John Lennon, I think, there. But that was 1963. And Maura, Gay was commuting back and forward, wasn't he? He was presenting here.
And actually, when the Beatles were on the first time, they were such a draw, and they were practically unknown at the time, that there was such a response to them that they had to have them on the following week as well, you know? So, yes, he was commuting, and... one of the times when he was coming back by air, there was a bit of an accident, and he was trying to rush back to do the Late Late Show. But anyhow, the accident was with the airline, and a wheel fell off and it went into the soft grass. So thanks be to God, it didn't do any further damage, because he lived to tell the tale.
You got a friend. You mentioned the Rose of Tralee Marty. You were with him on every year. You were down there.
That's right. Well, the thing about the Rose of Tralee was it was Tom McGrath, who was also the producer of the Late Late Show, who covered the Rose of Tralee first, and Kathleen Watkins was the first presenter, but it wasn't on air. And then when Gay came to do it, he came back to the controller of programmes at the time and he said, you have to have this on air. And it was on air after that. I worked on it for 17 years with him. But initially when I used to work on it, it was like the National Dairy Council programme. I just gave him cards. Mm-hmm. So what he used to do was he'd ring me with a certain number of the roses and they would be lined up by, I think it was Mary O'Leehan, who used to look after us while we were down there and subsequently. And I would interview them on the phone and then Gay would ring me back and I'd give him all the information that I had collected. And then the following year, I went on an extended holiday because I'd worked up a lot of time and I went to Corfu and he got Coleman Hutchinson, who was one of our researchers, to go down. And then the next year, he got me to come down. So I went down every year after that. And the Rose of Tralee people would give us two rooms. The judges would be making their assessments with all of the roses one at a time. And then as they were free, they would be either sent into me in my room or into Gay. And we split the work, you know. Yeah. And then I would do up the cards for him for all the lot that I had done. And if he was unsure of anyone or felt he needed a bit more, he'd ask me to go and have a look at that person. Whatever, you know.
He entrusted you.
And then I'd fill him in.
He trusted you so much. Noreen Cassidy. Noreen, 1986, Rose of Tralee went on to become chief executive of the Rose of Tralee. I know you want to remember Gay, but you also want to say hello to Maura.
I do, Joe.
Thank you.
And hello, Maura. And it's so wonderful to hear your voice. And
Thank you.
Your voice would be as synonymous with Gay as it would be with all of us that were involved with the Rose of Tralee. So it's lovely to hear you. It's lovely to hear your voice, Maura.
Well, Noreen, you're the only one of all the roses that Gay picked before, because we used to have this little competition between the two of us, you know.
A sweep,
yeah.
Baby, yes.
And you were the only one that he had actually picked as the winner, and there you are. You're there.
Well, I never knew that, Maura. Isn't it amazing? That's very touching to know that.
Yeah.
And I never knew that, Maura, but thank you for telling me.
And people never knew. I know it wasn't broadcast. People never knew that the only female presenter ever of the Rose of Tralee is Kathleen Watkins.
Yes.
Yes, well done,
that
Maura.
That was when it was a stage production, not on television.
Wow.
Yeah.
And Noreen, your memories of Gay?
Well, I suppose, obviously, it started in 1986 when he interviewed me on stage and I was due to play the tin whistle and he'd arranged for one of the guys from RT, I think it was Tom Flanagan, to be honest, to actually take the tin whistle off me before I went up on stage. So when I went up on stage, I actually didn't know where my tin whistle was. And, of course, then Gay asked me, where's your tin whistle? And I look at him saying, I don't know. And, of course, he then says, oh, well, I always go with a tin whistle in my pocket and produce the tin whistle. And my year was a year where, unfortunately, when I was crowned the rose, the tiara fell off.
Uh-huh.
And as it fell off and it was being placed back on my head, I think it was actually being placed upside down, but that's beside the point. I always remember him saying to me, keep smiling. Nobody noticed. And then we moved on 10 years later and I was in another unique position with him whereby we both judged the Rose of Tralee, both in 96 and 97. So I had the experience of being on the judging panel with him. And one rose in particular that sticks out was an American rose who came, and for whatever reason, as she came into the judging room, which, as Maura said, was actually an extended bedroom in the Brandon in those days, and she came in with some rosary beads. And she sat down in front of us,
yes.
and there was Brian Brown from Guinness and John Foley from Waterford Crystal and Gay. And we had to do 33 interviews, because in those days there were 33 roses, and as Maura would remember. And every single interview of every single rose that came into us, I can see him now. He was sat on the edge of his seat, and he would lean forward, and he would give every single rose the same level of attention. He would listen to every story, and he made every rose that walked into that room being judged as if she was the rose.
Yeah, yeah.
But going back to this particular American entrant that had come into us, she had the rose rubies in her hand anyway, and of course Gay said to her, "What are you thinking of doing as your party piece?" And she said, "Oh, I'm going to sing the Rose of Tralee. My grandmother used to always sing it to me as a child and everything else." Now, bearing in mind, we were probably 20 interviews on, at least 10 minutes per interview, because, as I say, Gay wanted to hear every story. And so we said, "Oh, of course, give us a verse." All I can say is, and I'm completely tone deaf, poor girl hadn't a note in her head.
Okay, yes.
So she sang the first verse and she sang the chorus. And, of course, as judges, we all started clapping. And Gay leaned forward and said, "And the second verse."
Okay.
Now, there were actually three verses in the Rose of Tralee.
Yes.
We were biting our lips. We didn't know what to do. However, we kept it together and we didn't start laughing. And right at the end, after the poor girl had sang all the way through, just to show his mischievous side, he said, "Well, now, wasn't that wonderful? Do you have another song?"
No.
Well, when she came out of the room, we all went, "Gee, we're now 15 minutes behind." And his answer always was, "Every rose that's come, she's come from America, she's come from New Zealand,
especially,
she's here
yeah.
from Australia, she deserves her time."
Okay. Mm. Okay, Noreen Cassidy, thank you so much for those lovely words. That's Noreen Cassidy. Stay with us.
Another thing I want just to remind people too, that Kathleen did have an input into the live television programmes, because she used to do the summation of the first night's roses. And then did a voiceover the clips were shown, you know. She was absolutely brilliant at it. She'd just lock herself in the bedroom and watch the show and do it.
Thanks. Say to Noreen Cassidy, thanks indeed. By the way, Gay's funeral mass is at noon on Friday in Dublin at the Pro Cathedral in Marlborough Street, Pro Cathedral in Marlborough Street. Okay, say what it's 51551 Joe at RT.ie.
Talk to Joe on 1850-715-815.
Joe at RT.ie. Domo, Dominic Cronin. Dominic, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe.
And what was your connection with Gay Byrne and the Gay Byrne radio show?
Well, in 98, my younger sister Deirdre sent in a letter to RTE looking to, knowing that it was Gay's last programme on the radio, and looking to see could he do anything of bringing home some family members from Australia. We had 7 siblings in Australia and 1 in South Africa.
Wow.
And lo and behold, on the 18th of December, they all arrived at my mother's door.
But it was a surprise. And Angus McInally, who was involved.
He was.
Angus, tell us how the surprise was sprung by Gay.
Well, what happened was, I had gone to Australia. We left Dublin on Friday, landed in Sydney on Sunday morning, set up the programme on Monday. On Tuesday night, we did a full programme from a pub in Sydney.
Mm-hmm.
And then we said to Gay, when we finished that, it said, OK, talk to you in 2 days' time from another place. And we hopped on the plane the following morning with all of the Cronin family, and we headed back to Dublin. And then, brilliant production brain from Gay, he got 2 of the women in the office, the late Pat Costello and also Mary Aguiar, pretended to be 2 Dublin mothers linking up with their families in Australia, and Mrs. Cronin on the phone from Ballyfermot. And I'll tell you what, have a listen and you'll see what happened.
Good morning to you, Mary. Where are you, Mary?
I'm in Ballyfermot.
Ballyfermot, okay. Whereabouts in Ballyfermot?
In Ballyfermot Road.
Very good. Okay, now just hold on for a minute. Angus, who have you got to talk to first of all now?
I have Deirdre Cronin here, and Deirdre is the youngest member of the family. Deirdre, tell us about your family. How many altogether are there here in Sydney?
There's 7 of us. There's 6 in Sydney and 1 in Adelaide.
Right.
And there's 3 girls and 4 boys out of the family in Australia altogether.
And how much do you miss home at this point in time as you get near to Christmas?
I've been in Australia nearly 10 years now, and you just still cannot get the feeling for a Christmas. Yeah, it's just, you miss your family. Gotta say, you miss the cold. Mm. But it's just a really weird feeling going around the shops in shorts and T-shirt. And yeah, it's just not the same. After 10 years, you still just don't get used to it.
So who have you got here? Name all the people that are in Sydney with us.
I've got my brothers here. I've got my brother Jim. Jim is actually the eldest of the family, so he's here along tonight. He's like the boss. I've got my brother Philip. And if Mammy's listening, Mam, you wouldn't believe it, but he actually turned up.
Yeah.
I've got my sisters here. I've got my sister Bernie and my sister Jess. And I've got my brother Kevin here too.
Oh, fantastic. Yes. Fantastic. Philip, how you doing?
Excellent, Angus. Yourself?
Not too bad at all. I'm sure you want to send greetings home to your mum.
I'd love to, yeah. Yeah. Mum, how you doing?
Hello, Philip.
How are you going?
Oh, fine.
You really miss this place, actually. It's wonderful over here.
Oh, sure. You're always telling me that.
I hope you're all going well over there, are you?
We're all fine, yeah.
Excellent.
Dad is fine now. He's recovered.
Ah, wonderful. So you think we might see you out here sometime?
Well, if you'd never know. Stranger things have happened.
I think she's looking for the price of a ticket out, Gay.
I think so. I think that was the big hint right enough. Yes, I could hear that. Angus, before you go much further, could you find out, did you say six or seven were in Australia?
There's seven altogether, but one of them unfortunately can't be with us today because he's up in Adelaide. That's Tony.
Yeah.
He wasn't able to come down, but fair play. She was able to. Deirdre was great because she managed to get all the six guys and the gang to here.
Could you find out how come they're all in Australia? How did that happen?
Jim.
Jim is the.
Why are we all in Australia?
Jim is the eldest, is he?
I certainly am, Gay.
Hello, Jim. Good morning to you.
Good morning to you.
How long are you out there?
I'm out here 26 years now, Gay.
And how long is it since you were home?
Well, I haven't managed to get home yet, but I'm working on it one of these fine days.
So you went out first from
Hi,
Dublin?
Jim.
I was, yes. Yeah. I came out first.
Your mum's calling you there, Jim.
Hi, Mum. How are you?
Hi, Jim.
Great to hear your voice.
All well over there?
Everybody's well.
Chris and the family.
Chris and the family. Tim's just finished uni, so he's going to come over next year and visit you.
Oh, good, Jim.
Yeah, no, and everybody's fine. What? We all think of you.
What's that noise, Mary?
What's that noise?
Is there noise in the background, Mary?
There's an awful lot of noise.
Yes. But is there a knock on the door?
Yes.
I can't tell you what it means to be here. We're actually home. The guys are home. There's weeping and gnashing of teeth. Mum is hugging Philip and Deirdre and Jim, who've just walked in here. And there are tears in her eyes. She can't believe what she's seeing. Jim, that she hasn't seen for so many years. And the dad is crying as well. Everybody's crying here.
And in fact, what we did, it was again the brilliant production brain of Gay. What he did was he got half the family. We brought them all home, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But I brought in the first half, right? So you had the emotion. I was crying. I'm getting weeping over here. But then about 30 seconds later, knock on the door again, and the rest all came in, and it was just bonkers. It was the most wonderful thing to be part of. Everybody was crying their eyes out.
Okay,
and if you think of it, different time, 26 years now, if you think of what Skype has done, if you think of what FaceTime has done, of course, and all of that. And cheaper flights and all that, but the idea that somebody for 26 years wouldn't have been home.
What's your memory of Gay, Angus? You worked for him for so long. Your father knew him, Ray McAnally. Your father was a great actor. Was Gay an actor?
Oh, he was, absolutely. He was a frustrated actor as well. He loved any of the chances when you heard him sing in Oklahoma, where you heard him playing parts himself and Mike Murphy and people like that. He loved that part. And I think in order to have the command of language that he had, he was definitely an actor. I think his fairness, his meticulous level of work, and he was so fair. He really was so fair. I loved the fact that if you got something wrong for him, he'd say, who did that, Angus? He'd say, I did, Gay. Okay. Yes. And that was the worst thing to hear. And then if you said, who did the brief on Joe Duffy? I said, I did, Gay. Well done. And that was, well done was brilliant. And okay was all you shouldn't
have. Have we got him singing Who Wants to Be a Millionaire somewhere in the cart wall? Have we? We might get it down in a while. Yeah.
We get that for you before you finish the show, yeah.
Because he couldn't sing.
Oh, well, he loved it.
You can play the piano.
Many a great night on an outside broadcast with one cigarette, which you would borrow from somebody,
and a tincture
of whiskey would be followed by Fats Waller on the piano.
Yeah.
And he absolutely loved it. He was a great raconteur. But I tell you what, his insatiable appetite for finding out how you were doing, how was your wife, how were your children. Mm. And it wasn't just a generic kind of a question. He'd ask by name, how's Billy, how's Angus Og, how's Andrew, with everybody that he would meet. It was just wonderful.
And his party piece was a Cecil Sheridan song on the The Tattooed Lady. The Boards of Paradise were whatever they were. He loves Cecil Sheridan. He loves Cecil Sheridan. People don't remember Cecil Sheridan. He was a great writer. He died in 1980 and he went to the same school as Gay, Sing Street, and his genre was parody, review, pantomime and film. A bit like Gay in many ways. Thank you, Angus McInerney, who's now working on Liveline, and I think he's going to be on the 6 o'clock show on TV3 and he'll be on the Late Late Show tonight at 9:30. 51551.
Talk to Joe on 1850-715-815.
Joe at rt.ie. Maura Connolly, can I ask you, we never heard it on radio, obviously, but was Gay ever prone to bad language?
Never.
Never.
I never in my life heard Gay using any bad language, you know.
Incredible.
I mean, he was hearing
did
it
you
all
ever,
ra-
did
he
you
was
ever,
hearing it all around
yes,
him. You know, you can imagine a highly creative environment with lots of people very frustrated or annoyed, and you'd hear the F words and all the rest.
Did you ever have a row with him, Maura?
I never had a row, or he never had a row with me in 30 years. Isn't that amazing?
Incredible.
I was such a lucky woman. I was
he was lucky as well to have
well,
you.
Well, I was very lucky. And just when Angus was talking about tears there, I just thought I'd mention the last show of the last Late Late Show was the 16th of May, 1999. And, of course, we had a packed guest list and it went on for in excess of 3.5 hours, possibly closer to 4.
Yes.
And Sarah Brightman came on and she sang Time to Say Goodbye. And it was... like there was hardly a person in studio, crew and everything that didn't shed a tear. And it turned out it was the highest rating programme ever shown on RTE. And they reckoned that for the entire show that everybody in Ireland looked into at least part of it.
Wasn't that incredible? And his heroes, Eamon Andrews?
Yes.
Whose anniversary is today, Maura?
Really?
Yes, he died on the 5th. It was Ronan Collins that pointed this out to me. He died on the 5th of November 1987.
Yeah. God.
Now, that was his Eamon was his hero from the same part of Dublin.
Oh, absolutely.
Yes.
Yeah.
And did so well.
And you know, his favourite interview that he always said was Mother Teresa of Calcutta.
Wow.
And we had an unusual way of setting it up. We had what we called two bucket seats down front, close to the audience, with just one spotlight on Gay and the other on Mother Teresa.
Okay.
And there was a chap in the audience who had a helmet, you know, his motorbike helmet.
Yeah.
And when Mother Teresa had more or less finished her interview, which went on for about 25 minutes. It was amazing because nobody ever got a word out of her, only I do it for the love of God and I did it for the love of God, you know. And this chap passed the helmet around the whole audience, and with the money that was collected for the people for Mother Teresa and for the people of Calcutta that she was looking after, they started up a bank account in, I think it was Baggot Street. Mm. And ever after that, like, you know, a lot of money went out to Calcutta to those people and to help Mother Teresa.
Now, it's just been pointed out to us, Maura, that he was caught using bad language once. And he was caught by one of his closest friends.
I'm sorry,
Mike Murphy.
Yeah, it was Mike Murphy in Trinity. That's the only time he was ever caught. It was brilliant.
And Larry Masterson, who subsequently went on to produce The Late Late Show for many years. Larry, good afternoon.
Oh, Joe, you're a terrible man setting poor Maura up like that.
I wasn't.
Yeah.
What happened in Trinity that you managed to get Gay, and Mike Murphy, managed to get Gay issue the F word, I think, 5 times?
It was very, very... at the end of the day, it turned out very, very simple, Joe. We were doing the live mic at the time, and it was an extraordinary competition between the live mic and the Late Late Show. And part of the live mic was a candid camera sequence, which we did. And we had threatened to get Gay. And Gay had said, not a chance. You will never, ever get me. Mm. Well, the months went by and so on. And I ended up producing a documentary with Gay on heart disease.
Okay.
And that was our opportunity.
Okay.
Because we told Gay we needed to do a piece to camera in Trinity.
Okay.
And he he hated that because it was a recording and he couldn't be bothered. We got him down and he was so obsessed and preoccupied with getting the shagging thing over with that he didn't cop what was actually going on. So after take one, take two, take three, this Frenchman appeared behind his left shoulder singing French songs because it was the weekend of the French-Irish rugby match. And Gay lost it completely.
Okay, so Gay is standing in Front Square in Trinity College, where he got an honorary degree, by the way, subsequently, which he was very, very proud of.
Very proud.
And in the background is, as we know, Mike Murphy as a Frenchman. Let's hear a clip and hope it translates to radio.
Here in Trinity College Dublin, that is one of the most respected schools of medicine in the world. Indeed, for over 100 years now, they have led the field in the area of medical research and preventive medicine. Here in Trinity College Dublin, that is one of the most respected schools of medicine in the world. Indeed, for over 100 years now, they've led the field in the area of medical
and in the
research
back,
and preventive
in the
medicine.
Background, Mike Murphy is dancing and prancing and ooh-la-la.
Here in Trinity College Dublin, that is one of the oldest and most respected schools of medicine in the world.
And here
for over
100 Mike
years now, they've been associated... Does he understand the expression kick in the you know what? Here in Trinity College,
here we,
Dublin,
go again.
We have one of the oldest.
Here's my
Do you understand the expression kick off?
Oh, God.
Why couldn't we
there
play it
go.
Without the beep?
Well, I tell you one thing. He wasn't amused,
fantastic.
Joe. He was not amused.
I know, I can imagine.
He was a very unhappy man. In fact, it was about a year before he actually spoke to me. But let me tell you something that nobody actually knows about this.
Right.
A week later, we were doing Canada Camera in Coronel's Court, and very respectable woman came out, and we actually got her.
Okay.
And she turned to us and she said, "You know who I am?" And we said, "No, who are you?" "I'm Gay Byrne's sister." And Gay was absolutely disgusted. He came into the office the following Monday to Mike and said, "Listen, what do you have against my family?"
And
that was it, Joe.
And as we know, Larry, like yourself, Mike Murphy is one of his closest friends. He loves Mike Murphy. He loved Mike Murphy.
Yeah,
he loved the crack, the whole gang of you over there in television, the crack he used to have, and he absolutely loved it. Maura, for the last few minutes, and I know this is difficult, I want to talk about the last few years, because Gay, he said on that Lyric programme, which I think it was November this month.
3 years ago.
3 years ago. Mm. He said, "I've been visited by prostate and it'll be all okay. I'm just going to take a few weeks off. I've had robust good health for the 82 years of my life," which he had, "and now it's my turn."
Mm-hmm.
But he seemed to be hit by a bus, and then when he got up, he was hit by another bus. The last 3 years were tough, weren't they?
They were. Yeah, but do you know what? He never wanted to talk about it. You know, talk about anything else.
Yeah.
If you'd ask him how he was, he'd say, "I'm fine."
Yeah.
And he just didn't really want it shoved in his face every time and to be just part of, you know, a month's gossip or whatever.
Yeah.
He never
did "woe was me."
No, never, ever. He was absolutely heroic and wonderful and so proud of and so appreciative of Kathleen, and said, you know, even in front of the whole Late Late team, because he used to always take us to lunch for Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
And he continued that after he had left the Late Late Show. Yeah. It still always happened. And he said, you know, that... I'm getting...
No, take your time.
That now. He said that he... it's gone, I'm afraid.
Okay. Was it tough? I know Susie and Crona were so... And
oh, yes, I know what I was going to say.
Yeah, okay.
He said that Kathleen was just so wonderful and how he needed her so much.
Mm.
And it was absolutely true. And
they've been through
Susie and Ronan were brilliant. Yeah. The grandchildren
They're
were
based
brilliant.
In Dublin, yeah.
In Dublin, yeah. And Crona was brilliant as well.
Based
I mean,
Killaloo,
they are just such a family that you have to admire for their sense of integrity and openness and privacy at the same time.
And remember, as you will, Crona and Susie have grown up with fame. Like, their father was famous from the day they arrived. It's incredible.
Yeah.
And they
and he was so proud of them.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, I don't. And his grandchildren, Maura.
Absolutely.
Oh,
yeah.
Mammy.
Yeah. It was fantastic. He was a fantastic man. It's the end of an era for all of us, and we've nothing but the best of warmest thoughts about him, and we'll always love him, and they'll always be a part of our heart for Gay, you know.
Yeah.
And apart from my husband, Liam, he was the person, the male, if you like, that I knew for longest in my life, because I knew him for 51 years. And unfortunately, Liam died after 42 years of knowing him, you know.
Yeah.
But he was very kind to Liam and to me as well. Very, very kind.
But Maura, in one sense, what you've said is, and I know it's a much more personal piece that you've communicated, but for so many women in this country, maybe some of whom probably never met him, every morning at 9 o'clock, every Friday night, especially on the radio programme, he seemed to have an incredible affinity to women, and they to him, to their issues and the running away money and the marital relations and the difficulty with the mother-in-law or the daughter-in-law. He had an incredible affinity, and I think that, that affection is showing. Just as you mentioned, I mentioned the illness, but just to show the decency of the man.
Sure.
Niall Redmond contacted us. Niall Redmond is a paramedic with Dublin Fire Brigade. Isn't that correct, Niall?
It is indeed, Joe.
And what was your connection with Gay in recent years?
It's mad how time and sometimes it plays a funny part in your life. We're only looking at the note I have from Gay, but I'm still stuck in my locker in Donnybrook Fire Station here, thanking us for helping him out when he was in a bit of a sticky situation. One, I think it was a Sunday morning about, we were trying to figure out the year, I think it was about 2013 actually, that this happened, but we were called down to a house in Sandymount.
You were in the 999, the emergency ambulance from Donnybrook.
Yeah, we were on a 16-hour night shift on a Saturday night. It was getting sort of that real tiring hour about 6 a.m. And the quick story is, I remember getting a phone call from the control room to tell us we were going to... Now, I heard it as Glen Bourne, as in a house name. And I said, Glen Bourne? What? I said, okay, whatever. We'll make our way to wherever the address was. So, of course, none of this dawned on myself, and Paddy was the crew member with me. So we were brought up into this apartment, and this gentleman was sitting in a chair, was back to us, and of course when we turned around or turned to face him, I said, oh my God, it's Gay Bourne. I nearly died myself, and it took about chest pain itself, but I saw who it was, you know, and we worked away and helped him out in what was happening medically with him, and had him down to the hospital in a few minutes. But of course the next shift when we came in, there's a note from him, on personalised, headed note paper, handwritten by Gay Bourne.
Yeah.
I remember going home to me folks on the way home that night going, look at him, I forget. No, for Gay Bourne.
Right.
My folks couldn't believe it. But he dropped in a bottle of wine to myself and Paddy. But then, to further to that, I remember going to the doctor then about 2 weeks later, my own doctor, for a chest infection or something. And she said, did you get Gay Bourne in the ambulance? Now, of course, in our line of work, as everyone can appreciate, we can't tell anybody. Because, you know, somebody famous or our neighbour sister, we can't tell anybody. So I said, how did you know that? She said to the doctor, he said it on his radio show last Sunday. We listened to him every week. I said, you're joking me. So, of course, I went back and had to listen to the archive or the radio player. And there it was, thanking myself and Paddy for helping him out. I just thought it was a really nice touch. I mean, we don't regularly get people even dropping in cards or, you know, bottles of wine from Gay himself. I couldn't believe it, you know.
I remember he knows my interest in the fire brigade. He rang me from the hospital and he said, find out who was on the ambulance that called to me. And I knew it was Donnybrook, and I found the watch. It was ABC or D, I don't know what watch you're on.
D-Watch.
And I got your two names. And I didn't know he did anything, but the note which you've sent us in is the note I think we should send to Gay Bourne. Your note from Gay Bourne to you said, Niall, just to say, in his own handwriting, just say thank you for looking after me so well. The kindness and reassurance and competence meant so much to me with appreciation. And I'll turn it around and say, Gay, just to say thank you for looking after us so well. The kindness and reassurance and competence meant so much to us with appreciation, the people of Ireland. Back after this.
Joe Duffy.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
So far, we know there will be a special Late Late tonight in honour and celebration of Gay Byrne. His funeral mass is this Friday at noon in the Pro Cathedral here in Marlborough Street in Dublin, and that will be broadcast live on RTE One Television nationwide and indeed beyond. Tara Lockery-Grant produced. Apologies to all the people we couldn't get on, but we will be facilitating you tomorrow if that's your wish. Tara Lockery-Grant produced, and Ray Darcy is next.